powers and colonial powers relevant. And so King Hussein made Jordan relevant by being a mediator to all. And King Abdullah, his son, has shut the door on that by basically having relations with only one side. What is Jordan's relevance today except being a buffer state? I would argue that obviously the Saudis and the Emiratis and Gulf countries, because of their natural resources, have more longevity and reason to be for longer. What's interesting now is, as I mentioned earlier in the program, the younger generation coming in for the first time in a very long time. And this younger generation, what intrigues me sociologically about them is they did not grow up with absolute reverence and deference to the imperial power that established them. They went to schools, they went to Sandhurst, they went to Georgetown, you know, they went to Western schools. Right. They come, you know, while extremely privileged, lived unusually privileged lives in those capitals, Western capitals.
Right.
And, you know, with it comes a certain arrogance. So they're not going to be like their fathers and grandfathers, ultimately knowing who pulls the strings. They
right.
have agendas of their own. And I think that, I mean, we're seeing this, for instance, in the Palestinian youth today. A generation has passed since the, you know, the Oslo Agreement and
right.
the Madrid peace talks. And the parents of the younger generation emerging in the West Bank today were absolutely, you know, deferential to the Oslo system,
right.
waiting for the rewards of that and following and, you know, the system as it was designed to oppress Palestinians, but having Palestinians do instead of Israelis.
Right.
So, you know, we have another generation now that is turning conventional relationships on its head and maybe thinking differently about the future of their countries. So I don't see the Saudis disappearing overnight. I don't even think their sort of foes in the region, you know, Iran, want to see that. I mean, nobody wants a Wahhabi country with I don't know how many Patriot missiles and, you know, state-of-the-art military equipment to be, you know, disrupted from within. These are very dangerous scenarios. And almost any country you look like that have experienced these color revolutions and other kinds of internal disruptions, you have the falling apart of the state. You know, you have the spreading of small weapons, medium weapons, that kind of thing. Nobody wants to destabilize Saudi Arabia, you know, but I think that country is going to evolve like other countries have to in the region. They, for one, they fully understand that they cannot depend, as you said, on the Americans to help them out militarily, as was the case in Yemen when almost every Saudi city has been targeted by Ansar Allah missiles right now and several UAE cities as well. And there was no Americans to the rescue. In fact, these countries watched the Iranians lob a dozen ballistic missiles into several U.S. bases in Iraq without a reciprocal American reaction. They saw Iran shoot down an American state-of-the-art $200 million plus stealth drone without an American reaction. So they understand that the U.S. is not going to come to anyone's assistance, which is why this younger generation is now diversifying its relations with rising powers like Russia and major economic powerhouses like China,
right.
who is demanding in turn that these countries participate in its ambitious multi-trillion-dollar Belt and Road Initiative, which fundamentally will upend Western shipping and transportation systems and mechanisms throughout the world. The Chinese are going to create land routes throughout all of Asia and into Europe that did not exist, train routes and waterway routes. As are the Russians, and, you know, the Iranians, the Pakistanis, a lot of Asian countries now are, you know, have now for a few years been actively pursuing these alternative routes, which, by the way, make shipping a lot cheaper, but Correct. Importantly brings this valuable, important ability into their hands, into their national hands. You're not dependent on the Suez Canal if Iraq, by the way, has launched a project, okay, a route that would cut the Suez route, and we have a map of this we created for our site yesterday, by significant amounts, which reduces costs, reduces the cost of shipping by 20 to 25 days.
These right. So it would be going into the southern coastal...
In Basra,
and then up through Iraq.
Yeah.
That's very interesting, because, you know, we also, Iran has the Chabahar, starting in Chabahar and going up through the Caspian region towards Russia, and very similar things. So let's talk about that, because you had very interesting reports about this idea that this is going to be, you know, transformative in ways that's, you know, historic, very significant strategically. So if you could give us a little bit more on that in terms of, you know, this area, West Asia, becoming, going back to what it was historically, this center of global trade, this center of global cooperation between East, West, North, and South. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In the U.S., federal environmental authorities have ordered a temporary halt in the shipment of contaminated waste from the site of a train wreck in East Palestine, Ohio, earlier this month, amid fears of further harm from the toxic waste. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Website of Crane's Detroit Business has covered this story and tells us more. State environmental officials said late on Friday, 24th of February, that shipments of hazardous waste from a freight train derailment in Ohio to Metro Detroit disposal facilities were halted by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, following demands from Michigan lawmakers and others. The Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes and Energy announced the pause hours after Ohio Governor Mike DeWine said about 6 truckloads of soil were hauled away and en route to a site identified as U.S. Ecology Wayne Disposal in Van Buren Township, south of the Willow Run Airport. Phoenix-based Republic Services bought U.S. Ecology last year. The Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes and Energy also said it was informed that liquid waste from toxic crash site may have already been disposed at Republic's deep well injection facility in Romulus. Federal and state legislators had been critical of the shipments before they were stopped, at least for now. We were not given a heads up on this reported action. Our priority is to always keep the people we represent safe. U.S. Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, an Ann Arbor Democrat, said in a statement. She said she was making inquiries to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, the U.S. Department of Transportation, Atlanta-based Norfolk Southern Corporation, whose train derailed in Ohio, the state of Ohio, and all others involved in understanding what is being shipped, whether these are approved storage facilities, the implications of the decision, and how we ensure the safety of all Michigan residents. 11 of the freight cars that derailed on 3rd of February on the outskirts of East Palestine, Ohio, near the Pennsylvania state line, carried hazardous materials. Officials seeking to avoid an uncontrolled blast intentionally released and burned toxic vinyl chloride from 5 rail cars, sending flames and black smoke into the sky. The chemical, which is used to make hard plastics, is associated with an increased risk of certain cancers. Residents of Romulus and Van Buren Township deserve to know what is happening in their communities, especially when it comes to hazardous materials coming in from out of state, said State Senator Darren Camilleri, a Trenton Democrat. The communities that have to take this toxic waste were just notified late this afternoon and told there is nothing they can do to stop it because Republic is a private company and can choose whether or not to take it. This is inexcusable. Darren Camilleri, a Trenton Democrat, said his office spoke with state environmental and local officials. He questioned why the soil was being moved almost 4 hours away and urged Republic to reject it, saying it should stay in Ohio. Republic spokesperson Roman Balosky said U.S. Ecology is a leading provider of environmental solutions for waste disposal and has comprehensive compliance programs to protect the environment. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is leading decisions regarding the classification of waste from the East Palestine Trail derailment, and U.S. Ecology's landfill in Belleville, Michigan, expects to begin receiving contaminated soil today, he said, before the shipments were suspended. The low level of contaminants in the soil is well within the acceptable amount for disposal in our landfill site. This state-of-the-art landfill was developed in accordance with federal regulations and is routinely inspected by Department of Environment, Great Lakes and Energy. Ohio estimated that 4,832 cubic yards of soil were excavated from the ground surrounding the derailment site in Ohio. About 2 million gallons of contaminated liquid were pumped away, including nearly 1.4 million gallons that were hauled to hazardous waste disposal facilities in Ohio and Texas. The remaining liquid was contained and staged for future transport. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. Federal environmental authorities have ordered a temporary halt in the shipment of contaminated waste from the site of a train wreck in East Palestine, Ohio, earlier this month, amid fears of further harm from the toxic waste. Hazardous waste disposal facilities near Houston, Texas, and Detroit, Michigan, are planning to receive most of the contaminated water and soil from the East Palestine train wreck site, raising the risk that some of the dangerous chemicals could end up in the environment elsewhere. Deborah Shaw from the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, said on Saturday, 25th of February, the agency had ordered rail company Norfolk Southern to pause shipments from the site, but vowed that removal of the material would resume very soon. "Everyone wants this contamination gone from the community. They don't want the worry and they don't want the smell. And we owe it to the people of East Palestine to move it out of the community as quickly as possible," Deborah Shaw said. Until Friday, Deborah Shaw said, the rail company had been solely responsible for the disposal of the waste and supplied Ohio environmental officials with a list of selected and utilized disposal sites. "Going forward, disposal plans, including locations and transportation routes for the contaminated waste, would be subject to Environmental Protection Agency review and approval," she said. EPA will ensure that all waste is disposed of in a safe and lawful manner at EPA-certified facilities to prevent further release of hazardous substances and impact to the communities. Deborah Shaw said officials had heard concerns from residents and others in a number of states and were reviewing the transport of some of this waste over long distances and finding the appropriate permitted and certified sites to take the waste. The revelation of the contaminated water's destination drew outrage this week from Metro Houston residents and officials who fear for their community's safety. But the concern is not just why is it coming here, said Brian Paris, who is part of Sierra Club Gulf Coast's Healthy Communities program. If some of these chemicals are so bad that the only way to get rid of them is to bury them in a deep hole, then why are we producing these chemicals in the first place, he asked. A Norfolk Southern train carrying vinyl chloride, a carcinogen used to produce PVC plastic, derailed on 3rd of February in the small industrial town of East Palestine, Ohio, a town of 4,700 people located on the edge of the Appalachian Hills in Ohio. Disposal of the leftover contaminated water and soil raises new questions about toxic chemicals, life cycle as the waste heads to facilities with histories of problems. Environmental Protection Agency testing has confirmed that chemicals in soil and water include vinyl chloride, phosphine, benzene, and a range of other volatile organic compounds known as VOCs and particulate matter. Independent public health experts say water and soil are also likely contaminated with dioxins, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs, perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances, and other similar dangerous compounds. But the Environmental Protection Agency has so far resisted calls from them and Ohio's U.S. senators to test for these chemicals. The soil was scheduled to go to a U.S. ecology landfill in Belleville, Michigan, which sits at the edge of Metro Detroit and just a few miles from Ann Arbor, Michigan, two of the state's most populous regions. The contaminated water is slated to be sent to a Texas molecular deep well injection facility in Deer Park, Texas, in the same county as Houston, the fourth most populous U.S. city. The most likely contaminant to be released in the environment in Michigan in the near term is PFA, or polyfluoroalkyl substances, a highly toxic class of chemicals widely used in firefighting foam that experts say was likely deployed in East Palestine. It's also widely used in other industrial products and may have been in the train tankers.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has announced the operation of a new cruise missile with a range of over 1,600 kilometers. Speaking at a televised program, commander of the IRGC Aerospace Division, Brigadier General Amirali Hajizadeh, said the new long-range missile is codenamed Pave. The commander said this was to honor the Iranian forces martyred in the Kurdistan province. The Brigadier General noted that all of Iran's missiles are now manufactured with precision-guided accuracy, adding that all American bases in the region are within the reach of the Iranian missiles. Hajizadeh said, "We are now capable of targeting American aircraft carriers at a 2,000-kilometer distance." He noted that the U.S.'s superiority has been shaking after Iran developed its new hypersonic missile, which can maneuver outside the Earth's atmosphere and defeat all anti-missile defense systems. In a stern warning also to Europe, the Iranian commander said, "Of course, we have kept the distance at 2,000 kilometers out of respect for the Europeans," adding, "We hope that Europeans would preserve their dignity." The remarks by the Iranian commander came at a time when Europe has done its share of trying to antagonize Iran by closely aligning its Tehran policies with those of the U.S. After all, the European countries, namely France, Germany, and the U.K., have been maintaining a hostile posture toward Iran's defensive missile and peaceful nuclear programs. The EU has also challenged Tehran's regional influence and cooperated with Washington in its anti-Iran sanctions. Needless to say that last month, the European Parliament approved an amendment calling on the European Union and its member states to include the IRGC on their terror list. The resolution drew strong reaction from Iran. IRGC's chief commander, Major General Hossein Salami, warned that the Europeans would suffer the consequences of the move. The 27-nation bloc has also been slapping more sanctions on Iran over what it calls the country's approach toward foreign-backed riots that erupted in some Iranian cities in September. The recent IRGC announcement comes as the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called on the country's military to increase its efforts to attract, nurture, and train capable Iranians in line with the Islamic Revolution military doctrine. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has called on the IRGC to use its full capabilities to be able to protect the revolution and to strengthen the IRGC's spiritual and military foundations. This can be clearly highlighted in General Hajizadeh's comments when he addressed the issue of Iran's growing missile power. He has enumerated features of the country's hypersonic missile that was manufactured late last year and announced a new cruise missile's inclusion in the list of IRGC's military hardware. This brings to the spotlight the military might of the Islamic Republic, which includes capabilities of Iran's army with its latest underground base for fighter jets and more particularly the country's missile power in the face of the West's threats. That comprises threats coming from Israel, with the regime targeting several military sites in the city of Isfahan lately. While U.S.'s benefit lies in creating regional insecurity, as General Hajizadeh put it, there needs to be a military power in the region to deter such threats. Tehran believes that Washington is the root cause of almost all global conflicts, including the war in Ukraine. The Islamic Republic argues that the West Asia region sits on a security fault line, given the history of conflicts in the past four decades. Another factor that Tehran has always highlighted is the need to maintain the country's military might. It says if it fails to be strong, the enemy will bring the war inside Iran. That's why Iranian military commanders urge and advise Iranian armed forces to meet the security needs of the nation. Given all the threats posed by the U.S. and its allies, the Corps has always been aiming to render the American war machine ineffective and thus has managed to bring all the U.S.'s regional bases within the range of its defensive firepower. They have also turned Washington bases in the region into its weak spots, with the IRGC having the ability to strike U.S. outposts whenever the need arises.
Another missile test by North Korea. Four long-range cruise missiles. This particular test, however, was different. Even North Korea's media reported it that way. Strategic cruise missiles designed to demonstrate its ability to conduct a nuclear counterattack. The key word, counterattack. North Korea has been very clear about its missile tests, and there's nothing new there. It has been in response to the U.S. joint war games in the region, whether with South Korea or Japan. However, now it has described the weapons as strategic, suggesting that they are being developed with the intent to arm them with nuclear warheads. The scenario of North Korea's missile launches and the types of ballistic missiles came into full gear in the year 2022, during the U.S. presidency of Joe Biden. North Korea fired more than 70 ballistic missiles, the most ever. But why would these launches increase so much during Joe Biden's tenure? One reason, the U.S. lack of a foreign policy approach towards North Korea. Just war games and condemnations. The U.S. has even flown B-52 bombers in its war games. High-ranking U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham once said, quote, "If there's going to be a war to stop Kim Jong-un, it will be over there. If thousands die, they're going to die over there." Sanctions have been exhausted. Yet what has been missing is diplomacy or some kind of peace process. But the U.S. has no appetite for that. The U.S. track record shows that it chooses military solutions to foreign policy problems. But why, when in the case of North Korea, given that it has intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of reaching the U.S. mainland? In the past, the U.S. has used the preventive approach. The U.S. has in its attack doctrine preventive strikes, which differ from preemptive strikes in that they would not be a response to imminent attack from an enemy. Preventive military action has become a popular option among U.S. officials, culminating with George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq. But there's a more important reason. The U.S. may simply use this approach towards North Korea in order to make it give concessions. That, along with the U.S.'s long-sought prize, China. The U.S.'s coming war with China is now perceived as not a matter of if, but when. The telltale signs are there. From the U.S. national security reports, which cite China as the number one threat to U.S. national security, to arming allies in the region, like Japan, the Philippines, and Taiwan. For example, Tokyo just recently announced a record 26.3% increase in its defense spending, which will include missiles capable of reaching China. And then there is Taiwan, which aside from arming it to the tune of billions of dollars, the U.S. will be sending more troops to the island. The U.S. proxy war in Ukraine, possible showdown with Russia, its military threats against Iran, and its potential conflict with North Korea and China. Open Society Foundations described it best when it said, "America is in a constant state of war, and its founding values are approaching annihilation."
Malcolm X was the iconic leader of African American Muslims and a civil rights activist who was assassinated 58 years ago. The iconic leader was born in 1925 and was jailed for robbery in 1946. In prison, he was introduced to the Nation of Islam and became influenced by the teachings of its leader. He was assassinated at the age of 39 on the 21st of February 1965 by three men. Now, after 58 years, his daughter says federal agencies concealed evidence of his murder and she intends to sue the FBI, the CIA, New York City Police, and others for his death. Eliza Shabazz accused various federal and New York government agencies of fraudulently concealing evidence. She claimed the evidence shows the agency conspired to assassinate Malcolm X. Shabazz says she seeks $100 million in damages.
For years, our family has fought for the truth to come to light concerning his murder, and we'd like our father to receive the justice that he deserves. The truth about the circumstances leading to the death of our father is important not only to his family, but to many followers, many admirers, many who look to him for guidance, for love. And it is our hope that litigation of this case will finally provide some unanswered questions. We want justice served for our father. Thank you.
The slaying of the black leader has been the subject of speculation about the potential involvement of secret government agencies in his assassination. Back then, the FBI infiltrated black rights movements in a bid to dismantle them. Malcolm X was a lead spokesman for the Nation of Islam. The group advocated separatism for black Americans. Malcolm X later split from the organization and toned down some of his radical views. In the 1950s, the United States reckoned with its prevalent racism, and Malcolm X's assassination was a turning point back then. The civil rights movement, which was a campaign to abolish racial segregation, discrimination, and disenfranchisement throughout the United States, culminated in the 1960s. Various individuals and groups, most notably Martin Luther King, struggled to rid the United States of its institutional racism. But despite years of struggle and some success, structural racism is still rampant in the U.S.
It has failed, and it's very tragic. There's been so much suffering, you know, even when there is progress in the 1960s during what's often referred to as the civil rights movement, the liberation movement, there were gains made, but at the same time that there were legislative remedies made, immediately we see the mass incarceration system beginning. And we see neoliberalism taking hold, which impoverished so many millions of people.
The median household income for black people is 37% less than that of white people. And black people are also less likely to benefit from home ownership, the engine of generational wealth in America. Black couples are also more than twice as likely as their white counterparts to be denied a mortgage or a home improvement loan. Furthermore, only about 5.7% of physicians in the U.S. identify as black or African American. This statistic does not reflect the communities they serve, as an estimated 12% of the U.S. population is black or African American. One reason for this disproportionate number is that black people have been historically excluded from medicine, and life expectancy has declined slightly for African Americans. A black child born today is likely to live up to 74.7 years, 4 years less than a white baby.
So with if there is not a commitment at the top, if there's not seriousness about acknowledging racism and its impact, then we end up with the situation where we're in now, where the U.S. continually claims to be this racism-free country, when in fact it is anything but.
In a State of the Nation address in Moscow, Russian President Vladimir Putin has defended Moscow's military operation in Ukraine. Putin accused the U.S.-led NATO alliance of fanning the flames of the conflict in the mistaken belief that it could defeat Moscow in a global confrontation. He blamed the West for starting the conflict in Ukraine, saying Western countries led by the United States were seeking unlimited power in world affairs. The Russian president said Moscow was not fighting the people of Ukraine, stressing that Ukraine has become a hostage of the Kyiv regime and its Western masters, which have effectively occupied the country. He also accused the U.S.-led NATO of using the conflict as a pretext to supply Kyiv with arms and munitions. Putin warned that the more long-range weapons are sent to Ukraine, the longer Russia will push threats away from its borders. In an important announcement, Putin said Russia was suspending participation in a major arms control agreement with the U.S.
I have to say that Russia suspends its participation in the New START treaty. Let me repeat, Russia does not abandon the treaty but suspends its participation in it.
The New START treaty was signed in Prague in 2010. It came into force the following year and was extended in 2021 for 5 more years after United States President Joe Biden took office. It caps the number of strategic nuclear warheads that the U.S. and Russia can deploy and deployment of land and submarine-based missiles and bombers to deliver them. Together, Russia and the U.S. hold about 90% of the world's nuclear warheads. Putin also hailed the resistance of the Russian economy in the face of massive sanctions by the West.
As I already mentioned, the West is launching not just a military and informational war against us, but has also opened an economic front. But it is achieving nothing nowhere and will not achieve anything.
He added that the Russian economy has managed to do well despite Western countries' predictions of its collapse. Russian President Vladimir Putin's annual speech coincided U.S. President Joe Biden's unannounced trip to Ukraine and Poland. Biden stepped up his anti-Russia rhetoric during his trip. He pledged more arms for Kyiv and a fresh round of sanctions against Russia during a meeting with his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky. Biden proclaimed unwavering support for Kyiv and a commitment to bolstering NATO's eastern flank facing Russia. Biden's trip has also drawn criticism from inside America. Conservative Republicans have censured his decision to travel to an active war zone without a significant American military presence. They argue that instead Biden should have visited the border with Mexico or the Ohio town stricken by toxic waste spilled from a derailed train. Kevin Hearn, a House Republican from Oklahoma, who chairs the influential Republican Study Committee, said the president's now spent more time in Kyiv than he has at our southern border. House Republican David Kostoff said there are a lot of people here in the U.S. that would say he probably should have gone to Ohio and visited with the people who have been afflicted by the derailment first. Also, the right-wing American lawmaker Marjorie Taylor Greene said Biden chose Ukraine over America, while forcing the American people to pay for Ukraine's government and war. I cannot express how much Americans hate Joe Biden. The comments from Republicans were in many ways business as usual for the Biden presidency. The GOP has hammered him since practically the start of his administration for the increase in migrant arrivals on the southern border and more recently seized on the East Palestine derailment to argue his administration is turning a blind eye to an environmental disaster. East Palestine's mayor, Trent Conaway, said that Biden's Ukraine trip was the biggest slap in the face. That tells you right now he doesn't care about people. Last month, Biden visited Texas's border with Mexico shortly after he announced new restrictions on migrants who arrive in the United States, which drew opposition from advocacy groups and progressive Democrats. But the comments from the Republican lawmakers could also be harbingers of major political battles to come. Since the beginning of the war, the U.S. has supplied Kyiv with about $30 billion worth of weaponry and other aid, but the country has asked for more. That will require the agreement of both the Biden administration and his Democratic allies controlling the Senate, as well as the Republicans in control of the House of Representatives.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
IRIB English Radio.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we discussed the liberation of Khorramshahr and the events related to this great juncture in the history of the Islamic Revolution and the eight-year holy defense. In this episode, we are going to dwell upon Imam Khomeini's ideas about the status of women in society. Stay tuned, please. One of the important issues which had occupied the minds of combatants and thinkers during the struggles against the despotic regime of Shah in Iran was the clarification of the status of women in society. Imam Khomeini was always asked by journalists on the position of women after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The father of the Islamic Revolution always tried to clarify the Islamic view and approach towards individual, social, and political rights of women. He considered women as the core and axis of the family units and believed that if woman succeeds to achieve high grades of knowledge and spiritual and ethical values, she will be able to train children and keep the family climate more successfully. This will lead to an advanced society. The Imam was of the opinion that women's presence in family and their impact on men and children determines the course of society and the movement of mankind toward perfection and sublimity. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, strongly condemned the instrumental look of the Shah regime to women, which had trivialized them into the means of pornography and promiscuity. He would always support individual and social freedoms of women, but never agreed with turning them into the tools of meeting the carnal desires of libertine men. Imam Khomeini always called for serious and active participation of women in various scientific and cultural arenas. He said, "The Islamic culture is oppressed, and you ladies should be engaged in scientific and cultural fronts like men." Imam Khomeini's unsparing support for education and progress of women in scientific fields was quite clear in his family and personal life. While many traditional and religious strata were opposed to education of women, the Imam permitted his wife to acquire religious sciences and modern sciences. He would even help Ms. Saghafi in her courses. Ms. Saghafi says, "After receiving the diploma of the sixth grade, I went to Badriyeh High School and studied grade 7 there, and 2 months after starting grade 8, I chose a private teacher for French language. When my father left Qom for Tehran, I studied Jama'ul Muqaddamat with him for a while. Jama'ul Muqaddamat is the preliminary book for the students of seminaries. After marriage, Imam Khomeini would teach me. After a while, he told me that I needed no teacher as I was talented." Imam Khomeini strongly defended women's participation in political and social scenes. He maintained that the victory of the revolution was the result of the efforts and self-sacrifices of ladies. However, he believed that women's social and political activities shouldn't become superficial and ceremonial. In view of this, he vehemently opposed the special bill during the Pahlavi regime, which would give women the right to vote. As a matter of fact, the imam was not opposed to women's right to vote. He rather considered the move to deceive people, as in those days, even men had no real right to vote, and it was only the nominees, dictated by the Shah, who could enter the parliament. Imam Khomeini would say, "Islam intends woman and man to grow. Islam has liberated women from the miseries of the era of ignorance. Islam wants to preserve women's status and respect. It wants to give position to woman to end being a tool." According to Imam Khomeini's thoughts, after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, women's social and political rights were recognized in the constitution, and many women have participated in various posts for the past decades. Presently, a notable number of the MPs are ladies, and over 60% of university students are girls. In the first years of the Islamic Republic, some backward and short-sighted persons disagreed with women's social and political participation. But Imam Khomeini stood against them and promoted the issue while preserving women's status and dignity. The Imam's wife says, "One day I heard that the Imam had sent a message to the Iranian nation and stressed that it should be read out by Ms. Maryam Riazi on TV. There was an argument on the reason for Imam's emphasis. Everyone would say something till Ahmad said, 'The main reason is to remove the problem that had occurred on IRIB.' The IRIB president says that some of the anchors were ladies and Ms. Riazi was one of them who had been an anchor since pre-revolution. She was the best female anchor. The social atmosphere in those days was against employing female anchors. But as male anchors were needed in the battlefronts, the IRIB was in shortage of anchors." Imam Khomeini had heard the issue and said that women can do the job.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women, as human beings, are completely equal in Islam. This is part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah on January 4th, 2023. In athletics, you can see our young girls going out onto the sporting field and becoming champions. They win gold medals while wearing Islamic covering. In what better manners can you spread the awareness about hijab? Some of these women came and gifted me the gold medals Of course, I return these to them so they can keep them for themselves. But I am truly proud of these kinds of women. In an international arena, millions of people are watching them by way of cameras. An Iranian woman goes there, receives her gold medal, and raises her country's flag, all while observing hijab. Is there a way better than this for spreading awareness about hijab?
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Women have made progress in different fields. In scientific olympiads, in different places, everywhere. That is how it really is. Well, a few women here said that women are not being employed. They are not involved hands-on in the decision-making process. Yes, this is a shortcoming. There is no doubt about it. This flaw must be dealt with. However, the existence of all these wise, intelligent female scientists, researchers, scholars, and writers is truly remarkable. I really enjoy reading these books that are given to me about the biographies of the martyrs' wives, and the families of the martyrs. The authors of these books are usually women who have taken the lead from men. What writings! We have also female poets, very good poets. The poem that our female program host recited here today was a very good poem that she had written herself. This is also another point. I would also like to add that in these recent events, you saw how they worked against hijab and such things. Who were the ones who stood up to these efforts and incitements? The women themselves. The women stood up to them. They, the enemies, had pinned their hopes on these women, whom you say aren't wearing a bad form of hijab. They pinned their hopes on them. They were hoping that these women who have incomplete hijab would remove it completely, but they didn't.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round with reporters.
Palestinians in Gaza, including resistance factions, non-governmental organizations, academics, as well as civil society groups, held a national conference on Sunday to condemn the Aqaba summit. The meeting between Israeli and the Palestinian Authority officials was held in the Jordanian Red Sea Resort of Aqaba. It was also attended by representatives from the United States and Egypt. The spokesman for Hamas resistance movement said that the Aqaba summit aims to cover up the Israeli regime's ongoing crimes against the Palestinian people.
The Aqaba Security Summit will only harm the Palestinian cause and aims to abort the simmering uprising in the West Bank and Al-Quds. The participation of the Palestinian Authority in this summit only indicates the resumption of security cooperation with the occupying regime. We call on all countries to hold an international conference to support the rights of the Palestinian people.
The summit comes only days after Israeli regime forces killed around a dozen Palestinians and wounded some 90 others in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. In its final communique, the conference in Gaza stressed the importance of increasing all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation and protecting occupied Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque against all Israeli plots.
All forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation all over Palestine are legitimate and will continue to increase despite all conspiracies and challenges. We also warn the Israeli regime against playing with fire and violating the sanctity of Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians maintain that the Aqaba summit aims to sow seeds of division among Palestinians and to suppress resistance groups in the occupied West Bank.
The Aqaba meeting, which is going to be held today with the sponsorship of the Americans, Egypt, Jordan, and that will include Israel and the Palestinian Authority, is intended, in my opinion, to resume security coordination between the Palestinian Authority and Israel. And also, I think it's intended to crack down on Palestinian resistance.
Many Palestinians believe that the Palestinian Authority has become a haven for small Palestinian factions that have long abandoned the path of resistance against the Israeli occupation. Since the start of this year, over 60 Palestinians, including 13 children, have been killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Analysts say the Aqaba summit will only give Tel Aviv the green light to kill and maim more Palestinians. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The current world is facing many environmental troubles like climate change, dust storms, and pollution. In this regard, the Center for Political and International Studies of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Iran has organized its first national conference on diplomacy and cross-border environmental challenges.
This conference would be a very good turning point for going forward to rise the, let's say, awareness, let's say, global, the national awareness on what is going on, let's say, in terms of climate change impacts, in terms of, let's say, transboundary rivers, in terms of marine pollutions and sand and dust storms. This is the main objective of this session.
The four main issues discussed in the event were diplomacy and climate change, diplomacy and solutions on how to deal with the dust phenomenon, diplomacy and sustainable management of rivers and common water resources, and diplomacy and pollution of the Caspian Sea, Persian Gulf, and Oman Sea.
This conference is considered the biggest environmental event in Iran due to the comprehensiveness of the topics discussed as well as the number of speakers and participants.
The first National Conference on Diplomacy and Transboundary Environmental Challenges was held in the presence of the Iran Minister of Energy and the head of environmental organization at the Office of the Political and International Studies of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Also, several prominent speakers examined different dimensions of cross-border environmental challenges and presented their proposed solutions for the development of environmental diplomacy in the framework of separate and parallel roundtables. The head of Iran's Department of Environment hailed the efforts made to tackle the country's environmental challenges.
The general approach of the 13th government is that it sees environmental diplomacy as a precursor to political diplomacy. Fortunately, we've seen its results and achievements in the last year and a half. Considering the policies of the government that cooperation with neighboring countries is on the agenda, we saw this cooperation at a very good level, especially with the holding of the regional ministerial meeting of environmental cooperation for a better future in Tehran last year. God willing, the statute of the Regional Environmental Fund is being discussed between the countries of the region, and based on this important achievement, the United Nations thanked Iran in its recent resolution and introduced the Islamic Republic as the host of the international conference